from what I understand, the reason why you published those cartoons, and this is sort of our departure point before we go into a wider discussion, was you felt that societies around the world, particularly maybe ones in democracies, were indulging in something that you regarded as self-censorship, that people were deliberately not tackling certain tickly subjects because of perhaps of the fallout, because of the consequences, or because of for other reasons. Was that the departure point?
Not world ranging, I would say. And I would like to make a distinction here between self-censorship and good manners, because I do believe in good manners, but I believe that good manners are self-imposed, and we do have an etiquette sometimes, and that's something different than self-censorship. Self-censorship to me is when you, in fact, want to say something, but you do not say it because you are afraid what might happen to you if you do it. So it has to do with intimidation and fear and threats and so on and so forth. But the starting point of the publication of cartoons was a children's book published in Denmark by a writer who commissioned illustrations of the Prophet, because it was a biography of the life. It was based, in fact, on Islamic sources, so the content of the book was in no way controversial. And he just asked for illustrations of the main character. We do have illustrations in children's books in Denmark of the main character, and I think the same is the case in South Africa and almost everywhere else. And it turned out that children's writer had big difficulties finding an illustrator for his book. And it turned out that several illustrators turned down his offer to do the illustration and the illustrations. And the one who finally said yes insisted on anonymity, which is a form of self-censorship. You do not want to appear under your own name because you are afraid of what might happen to you. And this illustrator specifically referred to the fate of Salman Rushdie, the Indian-born British writer who received a fatwa from Ayatollah Khomeini in 1989 because of the satanic verses and novel he wrote. And he also referred to the killing of Theo van Gogh, a Dutch filmmaker who was killed in Amsterdam in 2004, because he made a documentary being critical of some verses in the Quran that, according to him, justified violence and oppression of women. So that was the starting point for the commissioning of the cartoon. But in fact, we did not publish them right away because we thought, you know, we were pondering, is this just one case, or is it just, or is it part of a wider trend? But then within the course of 1 week or 10 days, several similar situations appeared either in Denmark or in Western Europe. You know, galleries who took down artworks because they were afraid of offending Muslim sensibilities or of violent distribution. Translators who also insisted on anonymity, stand-up comedians who were afraid of satirizing Islam while they had no problem doing the same with Christianity, and the two imams in Denmark who specifically asked the prime minister to make his influence press in order to get more positive coverage of Islam, which in fact was a call for censorship, a call for using the tools of state power to get a specific point of view into the press. And these two imams also asked the prime minister to stifle the laws so that criticism of Islam would be a criminal offense in Denmark. And all of these instances happened within the course of 1 week, 10 days, and it convinced me that this is just not a single case, but part of a broader pattern when it comes to dealing with Islam in Denmark and Western Europe. And back then I had two questions. You know, is there self-censorship when it comes to dealing with Islam in Denmark and Western Europe? And if there is self-censorship, is that self-censorship based in fiction. People are sometimes afraid, even though they don't have to. Or is self-censorship based in a reality-based fear? And today, 11 years later, unfortunately, the answer to both questions is yes. Yes, there is self-censorship. And self-censorship is based in real fear because cartoonists were killed in France. Kurt Westergaard, whom you mentioned in your introduction, was almost closely assassinated in the beginning of 2010. And I myself, I had to live with bodyguards in Denmark around the clock. So it was not an empty provocation to offend Muslims. I did not intend to offend anybody, and I did not have so much focus on causing offense, but was more focused on the problems of self-censorship. I spent time in the Soviet Union. My wife is Russian. I worked with dissidents behind the Iron Curtain and had seen what self-censorship and intimidation of the public space can do to a society. So all that was the starting point for commissioning and finally publishing the cartoon September 30th, 2005.
Now, if one looks at everything that happened, were you aware at the time that in terms of Islam, that mm-hmm. most Muslims don't look positively upon pictorial depictions of the Prophet? Did you realize before the time, or did you sort of think that this would have caused a massive splash in the pond?
I didn't know about the fact that there is a tradition of not depicting the Prophet within Sunni Islam, even though if you go back into history, there are a long tradition, in fact, of pictorial depictions of the Prophet. In Copenhagen, we have a depiction of the Prophet from the 14th century that was done in Turkey, I think. And within the Shia tradition, there is also no ban on depictions of the Prophet. But I did not know all that back then. I was more focused on the issue of self-censorship and on the fact that Muslims in Denmark, in my point of view, you know, they are not strangers. They are in Denmark to stay, and they are part of the society. And therefore, we should not ask more of Muslims in Denmark. We should not ask less, but we should ask exactly the same of the Muslims as we do of every other individual and group, be it a religious group or a non-religious group. And these cartoons, you know, they were done in a long tradition of religious satire in Denmark. Mm-hmm. And they were in no way, in fact, transgressing the limits of what Danish cartoonists have done vis-a-vis Jesus Christ or even the royal family that many people in Denmark have some sacred value, though not to myself.
Were you aware, and this is what I found interesting about the cartoons, was that you found yourself going into two very distinctly different spaces. The first one was what one could very loosely call an open society where people would agree and disagree in a fairly civil manner. But the cartoons also crossed over into what I would call a closed society. For example, the Middle East, where people are ruled by despots and where freedom of expression and understandings of freedom of expression don't necessarily exist. And you have elements of that even in Denmark, because a lot of people in Denmark come from those societies. Were you aware at the time that what you did was actually going to go into two very distinct spaces, and that probably, in many instances, was the reason for a lot of the conflict?
Yeah, no, of course. And to me, the cartoon controversy is a very interesting case study in globalization, in the way the forces of globalization is informing and shaping a global public space where we have to work out the rules of free speech and the limits of free speech. I didn't know about that back then, but I have arrived at the conclusion that we live in a very different situation today because of, on the one hand, the digital technology, the fact that what is being published somewhere is immediately being published everywhere, and people can react to what is being published online in Denmark 10,000 kilometers away, even though sometimes they can't even read and write. And at the same time, we have migration, the fact that people are moving across borders in numbers and at speed never seen before in the history of mankind, so that most societies in the world, also Denmark, that used to be a quite homogeneous society, getting more and more multicultural, more and more multi-religious, and more multi-ethnic. And this is going on, in fact, in most countries around the world. And these two factors, migration and the digital technology, is creating a very different and new situation when it comes to work out the rules and the limits of free speech. And I just want to follow up with a point. You're right that there are two different spaces, and I think the interesting thing at the height of the cartoon crisis is that, in fact, in countries that have wide limits and a wide freedom of expression, liberal democracies, there was no violence. And liberal democracies where it is not a criminal offense to publish satirical cartoons of religious figures, while all the violence, in fact, it erupted in countries where there is no freedom of expression and where there is no freedom to criticize authority, be it political or religious or authority. And that's why I find it strange that some people called for new limitations on speech in Denmark and other Western countries in order to manage the situation, because the situation, the way it developed, showed that the more freedom of speech you in fact enjoy, the less violence you will have in these kind of situations.
It's interesting we're having this discussion because in South Africa we come from two sides of a coin. Before 1994, in terms of freedom of speech, there was none. And after 1994, there was freedom of speech. What is interesting about our constitution is how it deals with what we're discussing. It says that all faiths, all beliefs, whether you might believe in UFOs, or you might be Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist or Christian, all religions are regarded equal before the constitution. But there's a line drawn in the sand, and the line drawn in the sand is that we cannot indulge in sedition. We can't indulge in what the Constitution very loosely refers to as hate speech. In other words, every religion has the right to not be insulted. I'm putting it very, very crudely.
Yeah. But I think there is an important distinction to be made here, Shafiq, because there is a distinction between blasphemy laws and hate speech laws. Uh-huh. Blasphemy law protect ideas, I would say, religions against insult. And I think that's very different than protecting individuals against insult. And I think that is what hate speech, in fact, is about. We also have a hate speech law in Denmark, and in fact, we also have a blasphemy law. And I would like to get rid of both, but I think there is an important distinction to be made. And I think one of the problems facing freedom of expression today around the world is that increasingly governments and groups and all kinds of people insist that it is not human beings who enjoy human rights, but cultures, religions, certain versions of history, governments, and so on and so forth. And I think that is fundamentally wrong. I think any idea, religious, non-religious, should be exposed to criticism, inquiry, challenge, and so on and so forth. And that is, in fact, crucial to a society engaged in knowledge production. no one has a final say, and no one has personal authority. I can say I'm the Pope, or I'm the head of a church, or founder of a religion, or an ideology, to insist that I am more right than you are. So I think this is an important distinction to be made between blasphemy and what I would call racist or discriminatory speech when it comes to individuals.
Now, there's another question that arose from the cartoon issue, and that was, and I'll be totally blunt about it, there was a measure of double standards, because those who complained about the depiction of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, appeared not to have been as concerned about cartoons of Jesus or, for example, the Star of David. This is another problem area, isn't it, where one group...
I agree with you. I think we have to be consistent in our defense of free speech and not, you know, only defend free speech when it is speech with which we agree. I think the test is that when you are, in fact, when you have to accept and not try to ban or shut down speech that you dislike or even hate. And I think you have to be consistent. And if, you know, if I should talk about myself, I have in fact tried to be consistent. And I am now being criticized by people who praised the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad 12 years ago, because I have taken the liberty to defend the right of Muslims and Islam in Denmark to equality before the law and to the same freedom as everybody else enjoys. And I have also defended, in fact, speech of radical Muslims or Islamists who engage in hate speech or speak out in favor of polygamy or inequality between men and women or condemn homosexuality. I have defended their right to say these things as long as they do not incite violence. And that has caused quite an uproar in Denmark, and I have been criticized, you know, for being naive and so on and so forth, and not being willing to defend Denmark.
Interestingly, when one examined responses to the cartoon, there were some Muslim personalities who supported the principle of it. They may not have supported the actual depictions, actual cartoons themselves.
And that's fine. That's fine.
And then, interestingly, there were atheists who said that you shouldn't have done that. That is an interesting response, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is. And I think that was that is in fact one of quite interesting about this controversy, that the dividing lines were quite unusual compared to, you know, traditional politics. And even in Denmark, I mean, people with whom I usually agree on political issues, they criticized me, while I received support from quarters that I didn't expect.
Fleming, when one looks at this whole situation, what do you take away from it? I mean, you wrote a book entitled The Tyranny of Silence. I managed just to do a few grabs of it before the interview. And obviously the statement by Simon and Garfunkel on the Sounds of Silence, Silence
yes,
Like
yes,
a Cancer.
Yes, thank you for quoting that. Yeah. It's a nice song.
It's a very, very beautiful song. But, I mean, there's something that's quite sinister underneath it, and that is there is a conspiracy of silence on a lot of issues around the world, not just faith.
Yes.
But what is the biggest thing that you've taken away from your experience?
You know, I've taken away, I think, a few things. And speaking about the Simon Garfunkel quote, I think this new situation with the digital technology and the growing diversity of cultures and opinions that creates a situation where we more and more are living in a cosmopolis, where we are all neighbors, either virtually or physically, and we live next door to people who are very different and believes in different things and do their lives in different ways, that there are two ways to go to manage this kind of growing diversity. And one way is to say, you know, if you submit yourself to my taboo, I will submit myself to you, to your taboos. If it should not be allowed to depict the Prophet Muhammad, it should not also not be allowed to publish depictions of Jesus Christ or Buddha or Shiva goddesses in Hinduism. And if you want to be consistent, you should also do the same with with secular gods, not only traditional gods, which means you should also not be allowed to mock Karl Marx or Milton Friedman or Adam Smith or whatever secular authority you praise or support. It basically means that you should not publish things that may be perceived offensive to different groups and individuals. And I believe it sounds very nice on the surface because we don't want to offend one another deliberately. We want to be nice to one another and have a civilized conversation. But the problem is when you have this growing diversity, you will have clashes of opinions and values. And therefore, I believe that if you live according to this principle, if you accept my taboo, I accept yours, will lead to a tyranny of silence. Because in the end, nobody will be able to say anything that could not be perceived as offensive to somebody out there. And therefore, I believe it's the wrong way to go, even though it may sound nice on the surface. I would rather ask the question, what are the minimal limitations we need on speech in order to be able to live together in peace in the 21st century in a time of digital technology and migration? And I believe that the key limitation that we need everywhere on speech is incitement to violence. You know, I'm not a free speech fundamentalist in the sense that I think that there should be no limitations at all. I do believe in limitations, but they should be as few as possible in order to keep the peace. And of course, that's very difficult if you only have that limitation incitement to violence, because free speech is painful. It is very painful for a lot of Muslims to watch depictions of their beloved prophet. It's very painful for Jews or Holocaust survivors to listen to people who deny the Holocaust. Free speech is painful, and we should not try to explain that away. It is painful, and words can be hurtful. My answer just is that the alternative is far worse. So in order to live according to this principle, I think we have to reconquer the fundamental understanding of what tolerance implies. Many people believe that there is an inherent tension between tolerance and freedom, that you need to balance these two values. But the fact of the matter is that historically, tolerance and freedom are two sides of the same coin. Tolerance basically means the ability to live with things that you don't like or hate without resorting to violence, threats, intimidation, or bans. And that is difficult. Mm-hmm. It's not something that is inherent in human beings. It's really something that we have to learn. And therefore, it's a very fragile concept. It can easily disappear if we do not teach ourselves to you know, self-control, and rather to talk back than to hit back. This is something that we have to teach our children. It's something that we have to learn in school. It's something that we have to grapple with in the workplace and in the public space. It doesn't come easy. Unfortunately, today, this understanding of tolerance has been lost on those people, and they believe that tolerance is in fact about being silent when people are saying something that you don't, that you disagree with or don't like. Not at all. Tolerance, in fact, also implies that you talk back, that you do not use violence, and you do not try to ban what people say. So that is one thing. And following from that, I think we need to reestablish a very clear distinction between words and deeds. A fundamental difference between a dictatorship and a democracy is that a dictatorship criminalizes words as if they were deeds, and therefore dissidents, non-believers, non-communists, they end up in prison because what they say is being perceived as a physical threat to the regime, the dictatorship. Unfortunately, many people in the West, in South Africa and Denmark and in the U.S., believe that words can be violence. And I think that is really going off track. It doesn't mean that I don't say that words can be painful. They can, and they can be hurtful, but words are not violence. Violence has to do with physical attacks on other human beings. And words is very different, because that is what we use instead of violence and physical intimidation to work out our differences, our disagreements, our misunderstandings, and so on and so forth. And that is, in fact, to me, what is a defining character of a civilized society.
Mr. Flemming Rose, a former foreign editor of the Danish newspaper Jyllands Posten, also author of American Voices and the Tyranny of Silence. And, of course, he was the editor, one of the editors at the Jyllands Posten at the time of the Muhammad Peace and Blessings Be Upon Him cartoons. And, of course, The Tyranny of Silence is a book that Flemming Rose has written. And I'm going to read again the inscriptions. "Fool," said I, "you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows." That, that free speech at the end of the day is hard. Tolerance is difficult, but it's far better than people drawing swords and shooting each other. Flemming Rose, who is currently a fellow at the Cato Institute in the US of A, and also who hosts a television program, Flemming Rose, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. Everything of the best.
Thanks a lot, Sherry. It was a pleasure joining you.